Hello, and welcome to Ipsa Dixit, a podcast on legal scholarship. I'm your host, Brian L. Fry, Spears Gilbert Professor of Law at the University of Kentucky College of Law. My guests are Beau J. Bauman, a PhD student at Yale Law School, and Todd Phillips, Assistant Professor at Georgia State University. We will discuss their article, The Major Questions Doctrines Domain, which will be published in the Brooklyn Law Review. So welcome back to the show, Beau, and welcome to the show for the first time, Todd.
Thanks, Ryan.
Great. I'm super excited to have both of you here because I really love this paper and I agree with 100% of it, which is pretty unusual for me. And what's more, it was super clarifying to me because it's addressing some questions that I've been thinking about myself for quite some time. And I've been really uncomfortable with some of the answers that other people have been giving. And for the first time after reading your paper, I felt like I understood why I was uncomfortable with the answers other people are giving. So thanks for that. And I'm hoping we can get listeners to the same place that I am now by the end of this interview. So setting the stage for our listeners, your article uses major questions doctrine-based objections to the SEC's regulation of crypto assets to explore the ontology, as it were, of the major questions doctrine itself. So I wonder if you could kind of set the stage for that by explaining to listeners what exactly the major questions doctrine is, where it comes from, how it's been applied, and why it's important.
So just to get us started, like, you're absolutely right that this is about the ontology of the major questions doctrine. For the people at home, you know, ontology is just a fancy word for the nature of a thing. And this is something that's really critical to the administrative law field. You know, this major questions doctrine really snuck up on us. And there's this huge debate about what exactly we're dealing with. So how did this start? So the major questions doctrine started out as a anti-Chevron rule. Chevron is a doctrine of deference. Starts out in the 1980s under Stephen Breyer, who says, you know, we're going to have an exception to Chevron that's premised on the idea that Congress speaks clearly when addressing major questions. That's basically how it worked as an anti-Chevron exception for a very long time. But flash forward to the last few years, it's been transformed radically. It's been applied as a freestanding substantive canon that applies when an agency takes an action that is politically or economically significant and exceptional, something that's transformative. And, you know, this played out in the headlines with the eviction moratorium, the vaccine or test standard, a lot of the student loan forgiveness plan more recently in Biden v. Nebraska. So, you know, when this was all going on, my co-author Todd DMs me on Twitter and says, you know, Beau, there's folks saying that this new version of the major questions doctrine is going to apply to the SEC's application of their regulatory authority to crypto assets, and that just seems crazy. Like I there's something off about this. And we need to write about this because it's really weird. And I started reading some of the materials at the time, and I thought, dang, Todd's right, and I can't quite figure out what the problem is here. And we started talking, and we read some of the old MQD cases, major questions doctrine cases, and we saw that there's just a meaningful difference between SEC enforcement actions and the other major questions doctrine cases, which is, you know, all of the major questions doctrine cases are going after these huge nationwide agency actions that apply with the force of law prospectively to the whole country. And SEC enforcement actions are a whole different ballgame, and Todd can talk about that all day. You know, they'll bring a defendant or multiple defendants. It kind of looks like a criminal prosecution almost, but it's not a legislative agency action. It's not a nationwide action that binds the whole public prospectively. And we think that that's a material difference because of all of the different aims of the major questions doctrine, and argue that the major questions doctrine shouldn't apply to these SEC enforcement actions.
You know, I also want to jump in here and say one of the things that we have seen is the MQD has become almost just add-on to every action over or every lawsuit over government action that's being brought. It's just something that you can add on to the end of a complaint and have the judge start, you know, have to evaluate it, have to think about it. Bo is keeping a list of all the different cases where judges are dealing with this. And so seeing this just being thrown into all sorts of different lawsuits where it just really doesn't belong because the issues aren't of the, you know, nationwide economic scope that the recent MQD cases from the Supreme Court are about. They're just much smaller in nature. We really wanted to get a handle on, you know, what can we really figure out about the way the MQD works? How do we start figuring out what its domain is, where it applies? And we thought that working at this issue through the securities lens, where these cases are brought just under the color of statute, there are no regulations, it's just an agency bringing an enforcement action, can really help us understand what is the MQD about and start not necessarily constraining it, but just getting our arms around what is going on.
So I kind of wonder, from the perspective of someone who might think the major questions doctrine is a good idea, what kind of theoretical justification might they provide for why courts ought to be constraining agency action in this particular way? Like, what would be the justification for imposing this new limitation on the ability of agencies to exercise regulatory authority?
Yeah, totally. So like, what's one of the classic ones? This is the one that, in my opinion, you know, really was the vibe during the COVID era, is what can you use the major questions doctrine to do? They would say it's a powerful check on presidential unilateralism. You know, President Biden directs an agency to do something huge, something without direct congressional authorization, and something that affects the whole country at large in a way that's economically or politically salient, right? So that is a concern that people who like the MQD are like very much fixated on. And if that is your concern, you know, it makes sense that you're focused on legislative agency actions, because that's what legislative agency actions do. They bind the public prospectively. Usually they go through notice and comment, but in emergencies they don't. And if we step back and realize, oh, you know, the administrative state regulates people and entities in all different kinds of ways, agency adjudications, enforcement actions in federal court, you know, everything under the sun, we can start asking the question of, okay, does that concern with presidential unilateralism, does it apply with the same force in these other contexts? And to me, like, the obvious answer in the SEC enforcement context is no, right? I mean, I just don't see the same kind of concerns with the separation of powers, with enforcement by enforcement vindication of the securities laws. Okay, so that's one. What's another one? Okay, so another one is, and this is baked into the doctrine, is transforming an agency's authority without going to Congress for, you know, a rubber stamp, you know? Okay, so this is another reason not to do it, apply to enforcement actions, because the SEC has been operating through enforcement actions for decades. Todd, go ahead.
Yeah, sorry, not to jump in, but I think it's important to talk about what the SEC is doing in order to talk about how we think the MQD applies or doesn't apply. The securities laws say that the SEC has the authority to regulate securities. There's a long list of things that are securities, stocks, bonds, this kind of catch-all term that's an investment contract. We have a 1946 case, SEC versus Howey Company, where the Supreme Court interprets what that term investment contract means with a four-factor test. The context of that test is really irrelevant for our purposes here. Just know that the SEC gets to regulate investment contracts. The Supreme Court has interpreted what that term means. Okay. The SEC today is bringing enforcement actions against issuers of crypto tokens, saying these tokens are investment contracts. The sales of these tokens are investment contracts. They are being issued without complying with the securities laws. So the SEC is bringing enforcement actions against issuers in federal court, just saying plainly, you are violating these securities laws, and we want the court to penalize you, enter an injunction or do some kind of monetary penalty or something. So what we have going on with these cases, it's you have Congress writing a law, the securities laws, saying the SEC gets to regulate or bring enforcement actions over investment contracts and securities. The SEC bringing enforcement actions saying someone has violated Congress's statute. And third, you have the courts, the Article III courts, just adjudicating these cases. There is no separation of powers issue. The executive branch is not aggrandizing itself vis-a-vis the other branches. It's just every branch is doing its specific thing. And I think from this context, that helps explain why we don't think the MQD really applies here. As Beau was talking about, if the MQD is about executive aggrandizement, about the executive branch taking the laws that Congress enacted and going just far beyond what they can support, that's not what's going on here, because the SEC, the agency, isn't writing a legislative rule. It just isn't doing any kind of legislative action. It is doing the quintessential executive action of bringing a lawsuit. Every branch is playing its part, and we just really don't think that this can ever be a major questions violation, because there is no separation of powers problem. And from this kind of context, I think we can broaden out what the scope of the MQD is, what its domain is, and really understand its ontology.
So to the extent people are articulating, or at least trying to articulate, major questions doctrine-based objections to the SEC's regulation of crypto assets, sort of how are they characterizing the nature of their objections? In other words, why are they saying that they think that this is a major questions doctrine problem in the first place? And why do you think those arguments are uncompelling?
What we're hearing is that there are people who are saying the crypto industry is just of such magnitude, such a large part of the economy, I guess, that doing anything with it without clear congressional authorization is a major questions problem. The crypto industry is a little over $1 trillion in value worldwide, and being able to throw that number, $1 trillion, in a lawsuit, sounds really good. We don't think that's very compelling, because that's $1 trillion worldwide. You have Apple, which is a $2 trillion company. So the entire crypto ecosystem is worth half of Apple. And we're not going to say that anything regulating Apple is a major question. So just, throwing that out there. What we're also hearing is people really want the SEC to write a regulation detailing how it is going to regulate crypto assets. And until that regulation is put in place, they say the SEC can't do anything. It is regulation by enforcement. Is a term we hear. And by engaging in regulation by enforcement that is violating the major questions doctrine. I can't really explain how it is. It's just an argument that is thrown out there. And our rebuttal to that is it's just enforcing the law. There is no regulation by enforcement. They are just bringing a lawsuit. That is how law enforcement has worked for forever. And so I understand these folks' interest in having the SEC write a regulation. The crypto exchange Coinbase has filed a petition with the SEC. The SEC denied it, and Coinbase is now suing in the Third Circuit, trying to get the Third Circuit to compel the SEC to write a rule. Among other things, you know, as I said before, the Supreme Court has interpreted the term investment contract through this Howey test, the four-factor test. There have been a number of cases where the Supreme Court has indicated, it hasn't come out explicitly, but it's really indicated, that four-factor test is what defines a security, and the SEC has no legal authority to write a regulation, even if it wanted to. And so it is our contention that if the SEC even were to do what the industry wants and write a regulation detailing what is a security and what isn't, that would be going beyond its statutory mandate. There you know, are other issues here, but I think those are really the main ones of why people are saying there are MQD issues and our rebuttals against them.
You know, and, you know, Todd, let me know if you disagree, but, you know, sometimes when I'm reading scholarship on the subject, or I'm not sure about the briefs, but, you know, ambiently, I think that people try to use the MQD as a vehicle to litigate their belief that these are not investment contracts under Howey. And that's yes. The weirdest thing about this conversation is, well, they'll say this is a like radical transformation of what the SEC has previously regulated. And, you know, I think our answer in this paper is, you know, cool, go to court and litigate Howey. That's the answer. But, you know, I get the sense that they're trying to use the MQD almost as like a thumb on the scale or something, which is really weird to me.
This is one thing I took away from the paper, kind of, which is that normally when people are bringing a major questions doctrine challenge, what they're doing is arguing with the agency about the agency's interpretation of the statute. And here it seems like what they're really doing is arguing with the agency about what the Supreme Court told it it could do.
Yes. I mean, that is exactly it. So we are seeing some people make MQD arguments on the grounds that, well, the Howey test doesn't accurately define what an investment contract is. And I find these arguments, well, I find the argument that Howey does not accurately define the term investment contract as interesting. I don't think it's a major questions doctrine issue. I think it's a, you know, statutory interpretation issue, in which case, yes, go to court, get the Supreme Court to change its interpretation of Howey, but don't call it a major questions issue. We're also seeing people concerned or disagree with the SEC about how it is applying the Howey test when it decides to bring a case. You know, whenever an agency is going to bring an enforcement action, clearly it thinks it's going to win. It has some interpretive authority to say, we apply this test to these facts. We think it's good enough that we're willing to go to court and try to get judges to agree with us. But there are some people who are disagreeing with what the SEC is doing there and saying, you're applying Howey wrong before you bring a lawsuit. And that is a major questions doctrine violation, which again is just the MQD has become such that it's just people throwing this against the wall, putting it in every complaint against an agency.
Every federal district court in Texas.
Every federal district court in Texas. I think it's people just trying to append an MQD argument because it's free. Complaints can be as long as you want them to be. There really is no page limit. And so I really think it's just lawyers throwing it in because maybe they will be successful. And I think the crypto industry just really, really, really doesn't like what the SEC is doing. And if they don't like what the SEC is doing, it must be an MQD violation.
Yes, absolutely. And, one thing that I love about this is, these companies are litigating this issue in real time. And, me and Todd have looked into these cases and sometimes we'll file an amicus brief or do something like that. And this argument is the first thing I've written where it's immediately gotten picked up by agencies. So like the SEC basically just makes this argument. The FTC made this argument and won. But in the cases where we're filing these amicus briefs, we're like, listen, this is like not a thing. Applying the MQD to agency enforcement actions in federal court. And it's basically been crickets. Like I have not seen a brief in reply to that argument that has cited a case saying we're wrong, A, or B, provided like a really clear rationale for why we would be wrong.
Yeah, because I guess my takeaway from the paper really was that the reason for the MQD doctrine is, or the MQD is to provide a vehicle for challenging the agency's own internal actions enforcing its own rules. But here the SEC it's doing all of its enforcement through the courts. So if you disagree with the SEC's interpretation of Howey, then just tell the court why the SEC is wrong and you win, right? I mean, you've got your venue there for enforcing or for getting the outcome that you think you want.
I couldn't agree with you more. And let me also throw another wrinkle into this, which is that the securities laws have a private right of action. And so if the MQD argument wins the day and the SEC loses on MQD grounds, what happens when a private actor brings the exact same lawsuit? There is, in that case, there is no government action because the agency isn't doing anything. We have one private actor suing another private actor. It would be absurd if the MQD was to apply in one instance, but not in the other instance. We can't have one court saying, because the SEC brought the challenge, this crypto token is not a security, but because a private actor brought it, it is a security. It either has to be one or the other. It can't be both or neither. Just because there is this private right of action, it makes the argument that what the SEC is doing here is a violation. It just makes that argument so absurd. It's just so clearly not an MQD violation.
So bringing it back to the kind of more theoretical kind of holistic perspective on why the major questions doctrine exists in the first place and what kinds of things it's supposed to cover. Kind of in a nutshell, how would you characterize what these arguments about the SEC show us about why this isn't the kind of enforcement action or agency action where the major questions doctrine is actually relevant to thinking about the scope of agency power and the ability of agencies to exercise power in this particular way?
what I think we can tell from the arguments that are being made from these SEC cases is that for the MQD to apply, just at bare minimum, there has to be some kind of legislative action on the part of the agency. Legislative action here is generally writing a regulation, notice and comment, or good cause. There's a question about whether agency adjudications are legislative versus interpretive adjudicatory. That's something I hope to delve into in another paper. But if agency adjudications before ALJs or the agency head are legislative, then those types of things could be MQD issues. The MQD is just not going to be about enforcement actions brought under the color of statute without any kind of regulations. Okay, so when we look at that universe, we're kind of just narrowing down from the full universe of agency actions. We're narrowing it down to legislative agency actions. And then from there, I think we can start applying the Supreme Court's economic significance tests, political significance tests. The court still has to flesh those out. I think we can get some kind of understanding based on the cases that it has decided. But I think we need to think about the universe that it applies to much more narrowly than I think a lot of people have been so far.
This is the move in the paper, right? So we found the problem and we saw that, you know, this doesn't look like the other cases because it's agency enforcement actions. So then you have to think of, this is legal scholarship, right? Like, in my view, what legal scholarship is a closed set of moves that you make. And what the moves do is they take the content of your argument and make it legible to the other scholars who are hopefully reading your stuff. And like in administrative law, this is a domain move, you know? So when Chevron was a thing, there was a big discussion about what kind of agency action Chevron is going to apply to. And that's like me doctrine, you know? And the, Kristen Hickman is the administrative law maven I associate with this move. So that was like what me and Todd landed on is like, let's set up a new framework for talking about the major question doctrine's domain. And, you know, I think the clearest case is the one we've landed on, which is judicial enforcement actions. Like, it just doesn't check any of the boxes, any of the concerns that are typically associated with major questions doctrine. But the administrative state is vast. So these issues, these domain issues, this is going to be a huge part of the future of the doctrine. Do agency adjudications count? Mm-hmm. Does licensing count? You know, you could keep going down the list, and these are issues that are going to have to be litigated over and over again. And they are being litigated. Todd mentioned that I have this tracker going, along with the litigation surrounding the triggers for the doctrine. You know, what is politically significant? These domain issues are some of the most pressing questions that are being litigated in the lower federal courts today. So what we're hoping is, you know, if you're a litigator or you're a scholar and you're seeing the MQD apply to a new area, you're going to see the domain framework we developed and apply it to new situations.
Yeah. So, I mean, it seems to me that the real problem here is that the people objecting to what the SEC is doing are in effect unhappy that the SEC has not provided them with clarity about what it considers a security, or I would even put it slightly differently, like what the SEC thinks it should be regulating and maybe what it thinks it shouldn't be regulating. You know, maybe that's a reasonable thing to be unhappy about. It's maybe just not a major questions doctrine problem.
I think that's right. You know, we can agree or disagree about how the SEC is going about handling crypto, but I think we can all agree that it's not violating the major questions doctrine while doing it.
Yes, lawful but awful, or lawful but not awful in this particular way is always an answer.
Amazing. Well, Todd, Bo, this was great. I really appreciated getting your perspective on this and talking to you about it. I love the paper. I hope listeners will check out the paper and read it themselves, because it's really, it's great administrative law scholarship, and it's also, I think, really enlightening on, for anyone who's interested in crypto regulation and the SEC. I think it'll be really clarifying for them in thinking about what's at stake right now and how to better understand the disagreement between the parties.
Thanks for having us, Brian. It's always fun to chat.
Yeah, thanks so much. It's been
Well, welcome to Howard Baker on KNX. Howard, how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, Nelson. It's nice to be here with you.
Well, it's wonderful to talk to an outstanding citrus grower, and I'm going to ask you some leading questions on the life of a grower. Can you fill me in on a point or two?
Well, I can try. What kind of thing would you like to know?
Well, I'd like to know, is the citrus life a good life? Does the grower have lots of worries? In other words, how do you spend the day? Do you get up early?
I get up reasonably early. I have my worries. Don't you have yours?
Very few, only that the microphone will explode.
Oh, well, lots of things besides microphones can explode in the citrus business. But it really all comes down to the fact that we live in a mechanical age, and with good equipment for pest control and fertilization and irrigation and cultivation, we get along pretty well. We don't have to work too hard
anymore. Does a citrus grower today do a lot of his own work?
I think it's about 50-50 here in our area. Many growers try to do nearly all of their own work. Of course, for the specialized jobs, they bring in the specialized men and the specialized equipment, and that takes some of the strain off of it. Perhaps the other 50% have a setup, as I do indeed, in which I get most of my work done by specialists.
And when you get to the picking season, does the association or packing house send picking crews out?
Yes, that's the big change from my boyhood. We no longer get out and hunt up pickers and try to pick our own crop. Now we do it on the cooperative basis, just like the rest of our marketing. Our packing house sends the crews out, and after consulting with us, starts in and picks the crop for us. Hauling's done about the same way.
And I'd like to ask you, what size grove is necessary for a family to have to get by? In other words, to make a modest living, as a general rule. That might be a leading question.
That is a leading question, because who's to say in this day and age what a good, modest living is? Certainly, the size of the grove that is necessary for that has gone up in acreage, or at least the realization that we need a bigger a cash income than could be derived from 10 acres has come about. I would say that probably to have a good, modest American livelihood and not to have too many troubles financially, probably a person would need about, well, maybe 30 acres for average-sized farm of pretty good oranges. That's just my impression of it. That's very relative, you know.
And what production per acre would you need?
I think nowadays you ought to have at least 400 boxes per acre.
Uh-huh. And what could you expect as a net income on 30 acres if you got 400 boxes per acre?
Oh, probably $5,000 or $6,000.
Uh-huh. Now, another question. You have worries in addition to pests from such things as frost in this area of Tulare County?
Oh, yes, indeed, we do. But it would be some encouragement to the new grower, if he were planning a grove, to recognize that now we have areas that can be planted where the frost hazard is much less than it was before. We have learned a lot about the lay of the land and its effect on frost. Also, I think we derive a great deal of benefit from wind machines and the combination of wind machines and heaters. We've had a little luck the last few years, I think, too, in frost.
Now, in your off season, do you have a chance to go fishing, Howard?
Nelson, there is no off season. It's amazing how perhaps we are more busy during the winter getting ready for the next year's season than we are in the season itself. But we can take off a day or a week pretty easily now and then, especially between irrigations in the summer, and we can go up into these mountains and fish.
Do you think there are unknown factors in the citrus growing business that make the job in the future of getting high yields more complicated, say, than it's been in the past?
Oh, yes. We're always on our toes, recognizing that any day some pest might show up that's never even known to exist in this country now. The Mediterranean fruit fly, for instance. We recognize, too, that rootstocks may be much improved. On the other hand, they may show weaknesses that we aren't anticipating. There are many unknown factors in this business, and so maybe that adds somewhat to the interest of it. We try to stay on our toes.
Are soil problems becoming increasingly, shall we say, dangerous or important?
They're not critical, I don't think. That kind of land, a good heavy land such as we have here that lies well and has drainage, I think continues to be a pretty safe bet. Of course, we have learned some of the hazards of over-irrigation on hardpan land. But I think maybe we've learned our lessons in regard to soil compositions and locations.
How much capital do you think it would take for a young man who wanted to get into the citrus business to make a start, say, on 5 acres?
Oh, now that's a very tough question. So if he were to buy a good growing grove, it would cost him, say, at least $2,000 an acre. That would be, for 5 acres, $10,000. Of course, he wouldn't have to pay that all down. And he could have an arrangement for crop payments so that he should be able, if he has a few thousand, $2,500 perhaps to get started, to pay it off in 10 years or so. Meanwhile, though, he'd have to be holding down a job or doing something to help out.
You think such a boy might take virgin land, plant it, and develop it?
There again, by the time the tree comes in bearing, he has to make a big investment. Perhaps not that much, but it would begin to approach it. The advantage there, though, is that he would have a young grove coming on, and with the new rootstocks, new varieties, we think we can get a heavy production and a better grove quicker than we used to.
How do you feel about Sunkissed Growers as a marketing organization for you growers here in Tulare County?
I'm 100% back of and a part of Sunkissed. Without Sunkissed, our life would be, I wouldn't be in it. It would be an impossibility to predict any likelihoods as to whether we could come out with a profit at the end of the year.
Are you optimistic for the future of the citrus business?
I am indeed optimistic for the future of the citrus business. We raise good fruit here. Up and down this valley, we can raise very, very good fruit. We have not been overcrowding our present markets. We know that the population is moving so towards the west. People's eating habits are changing so much that I think the demand for citrus is going to continue to move upwards, and therefore we have a good future.